Welcome to Fine is a Four-Letter Word, the podcast that empowers you to say, fuck being fine. Tired of being stuck in a place where you say everything's fine, when it's really not fine at all? You're not alone. I'm your host, Lori Seitz. I've been there too, and so have my guests. Here's a secret. All it takes is a conscious decision to change and then restructure beliefs so your actions take you in the right direction. That's where Fine is a Four-Letter Word comes in. Each week, you'll hear inspiring stories from people who have transformed their lives and businesses, and practical tips and takeaways to move you from spinning in place to forward action so you can create a life of joy. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get started. Imagine you start with a sense of purpose, aligned with your goals, accustomed to your family, supporting you in living your authentic life, and successfully practicing the art of the possible. Then, all of a sudden, it gets taken away. Stephanie Ann was raised in a supportive family environment that embraced individuality and encouraged her to pursue her passions. When she was 18, her mother released her to do what she intended to do. For 5 years, she lived the nomad life, backpacking worldwide. Then she returned to the United States for college, but missed the application deadlines. Rather than get discouraged, she said to herself, "Why don't we just sit down and talk with admissions and tell them why I need to go there and why they need to give me a full ride?" They accepted her and gave her a full ride. The art of the possible. Stephanie finished college, entered law school, and met the man who would become her first husband. Everything seemed fine, but fine is a four-letter word. Stephanie found out she had married a narcissist who gave her an ultimatum to either give up her dreams and goals and do as he wished, or he would leave. She acquiesced, and this is, of course, where her problems began. In a moment, when you meet Stephanie, you'll discover her journey through her first marriage, her divorce, and subsequent custody battle, and then her second marriage to another man who was remarkably similar to the first. Along the way, she went blind, as in literally lost her vision. How did she go from such a promising start of being in command of her destiny to finding herself at the mercy of the whims and machinations of narcissistic men to the point she lost her identity and sense of self? How did she get her vision back? Yes, her eyes work now. What lessons were her husbands teaching her in their own way? You hear a lot about narcissism, the love bombing, the idealization phase, the transition to constantly adapting yourself to anticipate the abrupt personality shifts of a man who claimed he never had an affair while he was living with another woman. Now, you're going to experience the journey in a way you've never seen before. So if, like Stephanie Ann, you so completely lose your identity that it feels like you've gone blind, the 5 Easy Ways to Start Living the Sabbatical Life Guide can restore your vision of your life's purpose. Once you read it, you'll discover a counterintuitive approach to making intentional changes in mindset and lifestyle. Learn how to own your feelings and your struggles so you can address them. Find out how to face fears, step out of your comfort zone, and rewire your beliefs. It's only 7 pages, so it won't take you long to get through. It could show you the answers to questions you haven't known to ask because, up until now, you couldn't see them. When you're ready to say fuck being fine, this guide is the place to start. It's time to be open and honest with yourself so you can make things better. Go to zenrabbit.com right now to download it for free. Now, let's go chat with Stephanie. She's waving us over to say hola. That's Portuguese for hello. Why is she speaking Portuguese?
Hello and welcome to Fine is a Four-Letter Word. My guest today, Stephanie Ann, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Laurie.
Yeah, we are in for a really good conversation today. I can feel it. I know from when we talked earlier, this is going to be good. Let's start off with, what were the values and beliefs that you were raised with that contributed you to becoming who you did as an early adult and then who you are now?
Yeah, you know, I was raised in a very healthy family. I have three other sisters, and I was kind of the athlete, the bookworm, the nerd, always got good grades in school. And, you know, my parents always embraced my individuality. And at a young age, I started traveling and traveled all over the world. And I remember when I was 18, my mom was like, I really just had to release you and let you go because you were just going to do what you were going to do. And I did, you know, I spent 5 years backpacking around the world. I went to college. I got a full ride to college. I went to law school. I did all these incredible things. And so, you know, I think some of my family values of family and being kind, but also being unique and embracing that individuality is something that my parents taught me.
Yeah. Where in the sibling order did you fall?
So I'm number two.
Okay.
But I'm very much a first child personality.
Okay. All right. I was just curious since you, yeah. Okay. And then, once you got done traveling the world, what did you do? Did you like settle down? Did you have people while you were doing that? Did you have people asking you like, so when are you going to settle down? When are you going to come home? When
absolutely.
Are you going to find a place?
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. When are you going to get married? Blah, blah, blah. And I was just always very driven, always very career focused, always very like, these are my goals. I've always wanted to do what I've wanted to do for a very long time. And so I was very focused on my goals.
Okay. So
yeah.
The reason I was asking that question is because, you know, I'm living nomad life right now and people are asking me that, like, when are you going to find somewhere you want to stay like, and actually live? And or when are you going to stop doing this kind of lifestyle? And I'm like, I don't know, when I get tired of it and I stop, that's when I stop. Like, I don't have an answer right now.
Yeah. Right. And you know, my kids, I asked them a couple months ago, I'm like, you know, we can go and do whatever we want. What do you guys want to do? Where do you want to go? And they both said, Mom, let's go to Portugal. And so we've been studying Portuguese. I'm on like my 115-day streak now. And
oh, wow.
I used to live in Europe, and so I'm familiar with Europe. I've never been to Portugal, so it's all new and exciting, but it's like, why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Absolutely. I love that. Portugal's on my short list of places I want to go because I haven't been there either. I did a semester abroad and I traveled around Europe, but Portugal, I didn't get to Portugal. And actually, I was staying with a friend for a couple of days last month, and her daughter and her daughter's fiance were in town. They live in Portugal.
Oh, no way. Well, you know, right after COVID, Portugal opened its doors and invited like a an invitation for the world to come and settle there. And so there's like
cool.
So many perks for us expats to go over there.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, so you did come back and chose to like quote unquote settle down, or what happened?
Yeah. So I came back. I was actually living in South Africa. I studied down there for a while and then backpacked around some of the countries in Africa and came home. I missed all the deadlines for this one university I wanted to go to, but I was like, let me just sit down and get a talk with admissions and tell them why I need to go there and why they need to give me a full ride. And I did. And they gave it to me.
What?
And yeah. Right.
Okay. This is a good lesson in asking for what you want and expecting to get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because admissions were closed. They were done. But I was like, you know, I fit the motto. My lifestyle is the motto of the university. This is why you want me and why you need to give me money to go there, because I've been, you know, traveling for 5 years. So, you know, back before I met my husband, my life was very aligned. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. I was going 100% in the direction I wanted to go and following my passion. And then I meet my first husband, and he was kind of the first real relationship I had. And in the beginning, it was wonderful. It was great. He was kind. He was loving. You know, it's that first phase of the idealization phase with when you're with a narcissist, like it was great. I didn't know at the time he was who he was. Right. I didn't learn that until I went to law school.
Well, I think everybody is, whether you're with a narcissist or not, and we'll get into that more in a moment, that idealization phase in the beginning, like you have this story in your head of who this person is. Mm-hmm. And because it's who you want them to be.
Yeah. Well, and in the beginning, they become the person you want them to be. Mm-hmm. They mirror your values. They mirror your hobbies. They mirror everything about you. And so when they start saying like, oh, you're my soulmate, you're this and that, you're my best friend, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, yeah, that resonates.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Like who doesn't want to hear that?
Yeah. I've just fallen in love with me.
Yeah. Okay.
Is what it is.
Yeah. Okay. Then what happened when you went to law school?
So when I went to law school, all my focus and attention was no longer on him. You know, before you have kids, before you're doing everything, you can focus all your attention on this person, because one of the basic fundamental needs with a narcissist is that they need that constant adoration, that constant like fawning all over them. They want all of your energy, time, focus, everything. Mm-hmm. But now all of that went to law school. Law school is freaking hard.
Yes.
It is. It is
heard.
Your life. You don't have a life outside of law school. And so when I started law school, it became my life. You know, you're taking 5 classes, that's 3-hour lectures every day, reading 500 to 600 pages and books and briefing cases and showing up. Because, you know, you have to be prepared when you get there to stand up in like the Socratic mm-hmm. method. And right. So all my attention was now not on him. He was not my number one priority. And he knew that this going to law school was part of my goal and what I was going to do. And so he told me within like the first couple weeks of starting, he's like, I'm tired of hearing you talking about the law. I'm not your study buddy. I don't want to hear anything about it. Just leave me out of it. I don't want to go hang out with all your law school friends. Like he was very matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, wow. I mean, that's super hurtful. Right. It's like, this is I've been working so hard for this. Yeah. And now you don't want to be a part of this life of mine that I worked so hard to get. And then he started focusing, his attention on seeking out validation and affirmations and all of that from other women. I did not know this until my third year of law school. Mm. He never came to me and said, you know, I'm feeling neglected. I'm feeling like, hey, we should do this or that. He never did. And so I never knew that there was a problem mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. until 3 years later, I found out about all of these emotional affairs and all this stuff that was going on. And it was devastating.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And so, you know, and that's part of when the mask comes off. You know, they become a different person. And for me, my first husband, he was a covert narcissist. So basically, it's like they're pillars in the community. They're wonderful. They're charming to everyone. They're involved in everything you can think of. They're the ones that are signing up to drive old women to go grocery shopping and then painting their mm-hmm. house for them. And then they come home and they are horrible people. Miserable, horrible people.
And so... did you tell anybody about this or did you just think it's my problem? I don't know what's wrong with me, but I got to fix me. Like something's so, like I need to. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in when it first came out with all the affairs and stuff, I told his family and I told my family and I told my best friends and I was like, I don't know what to do. And when I say I told his family, I don't think I told his parents and I don't think I told my parents, but, you know, like siblings and stuff. And because, you know, we both come from really good families. My parents have been married for 45 years. His parents have been married for 55 years. And so, you know, it's like, and I don't know why he love bombed me back because I wanted to separate, but then it was like, and then he wanted to, and then it was just, it was a very confusing time. Here we are, we're living in Michigan. in Michigan. We don't have any family over there. And, you know, it was just so confusing. And for me, I didn't know what his behavior was so off and so different. And I was actually, I had assessments with the State Department, and that was my route going to the State Department. And he basically told me, yeah, give everything up and have kids tomorrow or I'm out.
Wow. Okay. So what did you do?
Well, I gave everything up and had kids.
Okay. Because you believed that what he was telling you was the truth. Like, did he apologize for the affairs and say, I'm sorry, I'm never going to do it again. I want you.
Did kind of, but not really, because it never stopped. So then it proceeded for, you know, 10 more years of his behavior. And, you know, at the time, I just started focusing on being a good mom. I was doing legal stuff on the side and praying, you know, what is going on? And there was just so much gaslighting and so much just subtle manipulation that you don't always know what's going on, but then you just start walking on eggshells. You just start feeling miserable and like, this isn't working. But for me, it was like we were so entangled. Now we had two children, and I loved his family, you know. But you can't stay married to someone because you love their parents,
right? So this brings up the point that I am super curious about, which is how did he become like this? Because a lot of the stories I hear about narcissists, you hear they had a terrible upbringing, their parents were, you know, had their own issues. And it becomes kind of a self-protection. Like people become that way because they're protecting themselves because their childhood was so traumatic. And you're saying that his parents had a great marriage. And like, were any of his other siblings have narcissistic tendencies? Like, and just because his parents were together, also, I should say, you said they were together for a long time. That doesn't mean they had a great relationship.
Yeah. But they do have a great relationship. And actually, his dad's a psychiatrist and all of this stuff. So another way that people do become narcissists and have that disordered personality, as a child, my first husband was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. Oppositional defiant as a child can turn into narcissism, antisocial personality disorder, any of, you know, these cluster B personalities. So it's a precursor. And so, you know, he was a bad boy. I was a good girl. It's the good girls drawn to the bad boys. You know, I went to church. I was a straight A student. I, you know, all of this stuff. He got kicked out of every school he ever went to. He got shipped away to boarding school because no school would take him. You know, and it's like, okay, he's kind of a bad guy, you know. He's like, oh, I like this. I'm a good Christian church girl, you know.
right.
And so that is one of the ways as well. And so, yes, his parents are wonderful. They've modeled healthy relationships. In fact, when he divorced me, he disowned his parents because his parents kept the relationship with me.
Wow. And his siblings didn't have these kind of disorders, or did they?
I feel like his sister has some mental health orders. His brother is very stable, but has removed himself from the drama.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Sure, because if like any sane person might make that same move to protect themselves.
Yeah, so he was very good with boundaries, and parents were good with boundaries, which is why he disowned them. And he actually committed suicide a couple months ago, which, you know, it can happen when you have lived a double, triple life for so long, and things start to catch up, and maybe you start to become aware, and it's a lot to unpack and to deal with.
Right. Because if you have to face what you have rot, if you will. I don't know who uses that word, but I feel like, but it's perfect for this situation. If you start becoming aware of now, oh, maybe I was like, maybe feeling some guilt or some shame around it,
absolutely.
Which I know is from what I've heard. Again, I have not studied it as extensively as you have, but most narcissists don't do that. Like, they don't have that much introspection.
Well, yeah. And this is why they're able, after the discard, they're able to just move mm-hmm. on. And this is, again, where it's a personality disorder that is layer upon layer of protective self. So they disassociate, put a new layer on, become someone else, mm-hmm. and move on. But that is the only way that you can do that. Mm-hmm. You have to become a different person and pretend like that didn't happen. And that's what my first husband did. He pretended like I never existed and I was never a part of his life. He just erased me.
Yeah. And so do you think that what contributed to his taking his own life was that he started to take those masks off and to see what he was doing and feel what he
was
doing?
I think so. I think so.
Yeah, I know it's all speculation because we're not. Yeah, I
mean, exactly. And, you know, it's that he didn't leave a note. I never talked to him for 6 years prior to all of that. But, you know, what's interesting is he, about 5 months before he took his life, I had separated from my second husband, and he called me. And mind you, we never talked since the day he walked out. Mm-hmm. And just to speak about our children, that is all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he called me and he was crying and he's like, "Stephanie, I'm so sorry for everything I did to you. I was an alcoholic. I regret it. I regret leaving you now. I love you." All this stuff. Mind you, he's married. He's remarried.
Wow.
This is shit they do. And so that it's like, and then it messes with you because
yeah,
it's like,
it's a total mind fuck.
Then was that sincere? Was that honest? Like, okay, can we now have, because I was living in Florida and he was living in Oregon at the time, and the boys would spend summers with him. And so I was bringing the kids back, you know, for summer mm-hmm. with him. And so, and I was like, okay, so maybe, okay, this is what I wanted to hear 6 years ago. I just mm-hmm. wanted an apology because he lived in his own delusion. I never cheated. I never had an affair. What are you talking about? Okay, as you're living with another woman and we're still married. They live in their own delusions. And so I was like hopeful all over again that, okay, well, maybe we can have a relationship for the children. Like maybe mm-hmm. we can actually co-parent.
Yeah.
But then I show up here and it's like 1,000% different what he said. He threw all these emotions at me, all these litigation, trying to get me to lose, because I had full custody of his, trying to change custody, trying to do all this stuff, saying all this lies about me to the judge. And, mm-hmm. you know, here he is again, a pro in the community. He's a doctor. Yeah, I'm still a lawyer, but like, it's just different. Mm-hmm. And so, he had the kids for the summer and he started to alienate them from me. He took their cell phones away. I'm like, what the heck are you doing taking their phones away? They only call me. He's like, well, we've decided in our house, we're not going to have cell phones. The kids are too young, you know, just shit like that. And then you could only let them call me at 9:30 at night. They're falling asleep. My 9-year-old just started crying the whole time on the phone. Like, "Mom, when are you going to come get us? Mom, when can we go home with you?" And my 11-year-old was like, because I told him, I'm like, "The truth will come out."
Yes.
You know, the truth always comes out. And focus on that. And so my 11-year-old, every time I talk to him, he, "Mom, when's the truth coming out? You said the truth is coming out. When do we get to come home with you? Why are we still here?" Mm-hmm. I'm like, "Just focus on the truth and it will come out."
And that must have been so difficult for you to hear.
It's
to hear them
horrible.
Talk, yeah, saying these things to you, asking you these questions that you don't have a specific answer. I mean, you have a specific answer, but it's not a time, you know, there's not a specific time.
Oh, yeah. And it's like my hands are tied because according to our parenting plan, he gets some for the summer. Mm-hmm. You know? And so and I'm like, okay, so I could file to have a custody evaluation and all this stuff. But then I just kept feeling you know, spirit, like divine things. I'm just wait, wait. And I kept saying over and over in my head, vindication. And I had to release them and him to the universe and just trust that the truth would come out and that I would have my vindication.
How did you do that? Because that, again, is really difficult, but it's the only thing that we can do.
Exactly.
Trust well, and have faith. But what got you to the point to be able to do that?
So, you know, I don't want to be an angry, bitter person. And I don't want to just sit here and ruminate and fuss and fume and just freak out, because I could do that. Mm-hmm. I could lay in bed all day and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And just, oh, my life sucks. It's shit. It's a mess. Blah, you know? And I, you know, I can do that too. And it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And so I made a choice that, no, I am fighting this. I will have vindication. But Spirit kept saying, Stephanie, wait, let me take care of vindication. Because I wanted revenge. Of course I did. I have revenge thoughts. I have all this stuff. Like, what the heck are you doing? You completely betrayed me again. That's mm-hmm. how I felt in my head.
Were you angry at yourself for believing even for a minute that he might have changed?
You know, I never really got angry with me. It was more just the situation. It was the mm-hmm. judge. It was the attorneys. It's all these other, it's his new wife. It's all this stuff. Like, mm-hmm. what the? mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've had so many wonderful things in life. Like I was sharing in the beginning, like mm-hmm. when you're in alignment, everything works out. And so I know and I trust that things do work out.
Yeah.
And so I felt like there would be vindication. I needed to hold off on the custody evaluation as what I kept receiving. And I just had to give it to the universe, because you know, when we try to make plans for things to happen and we're like, okay, that has to happen like this, that has to happen like this, this is my revenge, I'm gonna do all this, I'm gonna get them. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the universe has a different way.
Yeah.
And I want to have clean hands. You know, there's this term in law, like clean hands. I it's not me. I didn't mm-hmm. make any of this happen. And so for those couple months, my mantra, my attitude statement was, this is hard, but not impossible. And I can do hard things and I will get through this. And yes, every day I reminded the universe of my vindication. Remember yeah. you? Where's my vindication? And when my kids would ask, Mom, when's the truth going to come out? And it did. It only took just a couple months and he attempted suicide. And then he attempted again. And well, he didn't attempt. He was successful. And, mm-hmm. you know, after I sat down with the boys, even after his first attempt, there was about 2 weeks between the attempt and him taking his life. I sat down with the boys and, when I told them that their dad died, and a couple hours later, my 9-year-old comes to me and he's like, Mom, we can go travel the world now. And you know, it's because I've always have been honest with them about their dad's behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, I stopped making excuses for him a long time ago and said, this is his behavior. This is what he's done. And I tell them in a way that they can understand
right, age appropriate.
It. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but I never hid anything from them.
Because they know anyway. Like
they do.
At the spiritual level, if you're telling them one thing, but they're seeing or feeling something else, then they have that disconnect and they're like, well, can I trust myself or not?
Yeah. Well, and this is why my 11-year-old was saying, when is the truth going to come out? Because mm-hmm. he knew that the truth needed to come out. Mm-hmm. You know, like all we can do is wait and just keep giving it to God. The truth will come out.
Yeah. You, when we talked before in our pre-show conversation, you told me a story about your eyes.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting story, but I don't remember where in the chronology it falls.
Yeah. So, you know, I was, I had just left my second husband, and I was at my sister's house and just kind of crying out to God, like, why me? My life just felt like a mess. Like, God, why is all this stuff happening to me? Like, my two ex-husbands are monsters trying to destroy my life and trying to destroy me and all of this. And, you know, it was in that moment that I couldn't see past the pain and suffering that had engulfed my life for so long. I held on to this victim story for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it was in that moment too, where I lost my eyesight. I didn't lose it in that moment. I had lost it before. So I was, I used to live in Florida, and I was out boating with some friends and my sunglasses broke. Well, I almost have yellow eyes. I don't even know if you can tell from here, but
no, you can't tell.
They're so light and so sensitive to the sun. And so the next morning after boating all day, I woke up and I was blind. I could not see, and it was painful even to open my eyes.
Gosh.
So I finally made it to the eye doctor, and they said, Stephanie, your eyes look like someone took sandpaper and just destroyed your eyes. I couldn't see for 6 weeks. And even just, I have contacts in now, but I only have been able to put contacts in just last month.
Okay.
Is how bad my eyes were. And so, you know, in that like breakdown moment, it was like, I couldn't see. I felt like the divine was saying to me, Stephanie, you are not seeing your life through the right lens. I physically could not see. Metaphorically, metaphysically, you know, whatever, I could not see my life, because when we're stuck in this victim story, you can't see the lessons. When you can't see the lessons, you don't know what needs to be healed, what needs to be released, and you'll continue to repeat these patterns.
Yeah. It's so interesting how we receive lessons. How the universe hands lessons to us.
Yes.
And so many times physically, like, makes you blind.
Yes.
To give you the lesson or give you the message that you're not seeing your story through the right lens.
Yeah. And, you know, I was like, why can't I see? This is so stupid. There actually is a disorder, you know, this temporary blindness. But then I was like trying to pull up in my head, okay, who in history lost their eyesight, and what was the freaking universe trying to tell them?
What did you find?
Not much, because I couldn't see.
Not much.
I barely could.
I couldn't do a lot of research. I couldn't see anything.
I couldn't. And so, you know, and I was stuck at my sister's house for 6 weeks because I couldn't see.
Oh, now she came on. I just said, hey, Siri. Like, you could be asking, hey, and she just came on.
But, you know, I was thinking of, like, in the Bible, I don't know if you've read the Bible, but there's, you know, Paul in the Bible, his vision was taken away as well. And so I was like, okay, well, what were those lessons that he needed to learn? Because I was like, I really felt this was, even before I you know, before that, like, being on the bathroom floor, was like, there has to be something freaking spiritual going on here, because who loses their eyesight? Why am I blind? And I'm being attacked by these men, and like, they're destroying my life. But, you know, when I made that shift from seeing them as monsters trying to destroy my life, and instead I said, okay, well, if they're not monsters trying to destroy my life, what if they're teachers sent here to teach me very powerful lessons? What would that look like? And what would those lessons be? And when I was able to make that shift, I could finally see the lesson. I could finally see what needed to be healed and released. And I could finally break these patterns of calling in these toxic, abusive men into my life.
How did you come to find out what those lessons were and to break yourself of that pattern?
Yeah. So I had to pretend. And sometimes, you know, before we subconsciously believe stuff, we have to just pretend. Mm-hmm. And so I got a journal and I sat down. I was starting to get my eyesight back. And I'm like, okay, first husband, Josh. If you're not a monster trying to destroy my life, then you are in fact a teacher that was sent here. What did I learn from 14 years of being married to you? Well, I filled a whole journal with this, by the way. So I'll share a couple little things. So, you know, one of the things was boundaries. You know, he spent 14 years having emotional affairs, and it ended with a physical affair. And there may be, have been physical affairs in there. I don't know. And so I can say boundaries. Because, you know, I thought I had boundaries, but I was being his boundaries police. I was boundaries for him. I was taking a little fence and putting it around him and calling out all the women. Don't you know he's married? Stay away from my husband. Why am I confronting other women when my husband is just over there having a jolly old time, probably laughing? But how many of us do that?
Right.
And how many of us put cheating over here and abuse over here? No, it's psychological and emotional abuse. Yeah, he wasn't physical, but he was psychologically and emotionally abusive. And so I can say, thank you, Josh, for showing me that I have to have my own boundaries, and I cannot be the boundaries police for anyone.
Yes.
So then I take that and look at my second husband, my second marriage. I thought I had boundaries in that marriage, but I'll tell you what I had. I had a toddler fence or a doggy fence. You know, those portable fences that you can shift and make designs and move? That was my boundary that I brought into my second marriage. I have a boundary. I got a boundary. That's not a freaking boundary. So he would push up against my little toddler fence and I'd pick it up, move it over. Okay, it's over here now. Fine. I give you that 5 feet.
That's not a boundary. Visual. Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, God damn it, Stephanie, we're in the freaking lesson already. A toddler fence is not a boundary.
Right.
And so, you know, so I just started walking through 20 years of that. What, you know, like the worthiness. I mean, you are worthy of so much more. Why did you put up with so much shit from your first husband?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was afraid to get a divorce. What would everyone think? My parents are still married. My mom's the minister of a church. Like all this stuff. Like, what are people going to think of me? I've been a success my whole life, and now I'm a failure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I'm not agreeing that you were a failure. I'm agreeing with your
You know, these are just the thoughts, and it's like, no, those people aren't in my life. I mean, they're in my life, but like, they're not living my life. Yeah. And I can get a divorce. If a relationship is not working, I don't have to sit here and try to make something work for 10 years. I am worthy of so much more. And I say worthy because so many people say deserving. You deserve so much better. Well, deserving means you did something to get something, right? That's the definition of deserve. You deserve that because you did this. Worthiness is innate. You are worthy because it is who you are.
Right.
And so looking at my second husband, I can say, thank you, Jace. Their names are Josh and Jace. They look the same. They're both Aquarius. Yeah. No more. We've broken these patterns. No Jace and no Aquarius. No.
But, well, maybe. I mean.
and so, you know, my second husband as well, it's like, you are worthy of so much more. Why are you trying to stay and trying to change these men? Because they don't change. In fact, we are the ones who end up changing. We think we are changing them, but we are the ones who become conditioned, and we are the ones who change.
Right. And not that change is part of growth and life. And I think what you're saying is you're changing in response to who they are, to morph into something that fits in their life versus growing as who you are.
Yes, we change. We lose our authentic self to become someone we are not, because we have to be all these people to be with a disordered personality. They're a bunch of different people themselves. And so we are constantly changing to to match whatever personality is showing up for that day. Who do we need to be today to make it through the day without an argument or a fight or stress?
Yeah. Again, back to walking on eggshells.
Yeah. And that's part of that, you know, their big move is the gaslighting. And I'll just explain gaslighting because I know it's a word that is just probably overused and not everyone knows what it means. But gaslighting is when you manipulate another person into doubting their perception of experiences or understanding of events. It's coercive control. It helps the abuser avoid any responsibility or blame for their behavior because they can shift it and say, it didn't happen like that. That's not how it happened. Or you can't take a joke. You're so fucking sensitive. Oh, you're on your period again. That's why you're acting like a fucking bitch today.
Wow.
That is gaslighting.
Yeah.
And then you internalize it and say, well, maybe I am too sensitive. Maybe I am a bitch. Maybe I am a horrible person. Maybe I am all these things. But I need to change myself now. I need to go to therapy. I'm the narcissist. I have a cluster B personality now. I'm bipolar. You know, these are things that they will say. And then they will say, no one will believe you. You try to leave. No one will love you the way I do because you're crazy, but I can handle crazy. So I can handle you.
Mm-hmm. It's a form of brainwashing.
It is exactly brainwashing. And this is why when you leave a relationship with a narcissist, whether you are discarded or you find worthiness in yourself and you leave, there are certain ways that you have to reprogram and I call it recondition because it's very similar to, I don't know if you ever took like first year psychology class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, remember Pablo and the dogs?
Yep.
So Pablo, over time, conditions these dogs to salivate at the sound of a bell. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the point where any bell, the dogs would just subconsciously start salivating. The same when you're in a relationship with a narcissist. They condition you to live from a place of reaction. Because when you react from an emotional place, it's subconscious. Or subconsciously reacting, and that is power and control for them because this is all about power and control. And so when you come out, you now have to recondition yourself. The world is safe now. You need to make sure it's safe. You have to rewire your brain. You have to rewire your thoughts. You have to get everything that's been programmed in your subconscious mind. You have to recondition all of that. And this is why they say it is like being brainwashed and leaving an occult.
And why I can see how coming out of the first marriage, you would come into the second one, having not done that work, come into the second one and have the same thing happen again because you didn't rewire your brain yet.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's exactly how it is. And people are like, well, why do you keep repeating these patterns? Well, it's because of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and because narcissists are charming, they're charismatic, they're beautiful. They can work an entire room, but they only want to focus their attention on you. Who doesn't want to be made special and felt seen and heard?
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. I am so grateful for your willingness to share your story and share what you've learned through your lessons and your blindness and your spirituality. Yeah. Being open to, I mean, I'm just fascinated that fascinated, I guess is the best word to use, by when you went through that experience of not being able to see, of turning to hey, there's got to be some spiritual thing behind this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I couldn't explain it.
Yeah, but a lot of people wouldn't have turned that direction. And that's why I'm especially fascinated because I agree with you that that was the cause. Because once you found the answer, your eyesight came back.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, we are here. This is what I believe. We are here to live our most authentic life. and to follow our passion and our whatever that is. I don't care what it is, whatever that is. And, you know, and I experienced that growing up. I experienced it in my early 20s as I manifested my way around the world and into a top university that I didn't pay for all these things. And so then you lose yourself. You lose your most authentic self because you're trying to become someone you're not. So you can have this relationship that you really don't want, but you don't know how to get out of it. And again, we forgot to talk about the trauma bond because, you know, so you're stuck, but you don't know why you're addicted to this person. You don't know how to get out. It's going to be good. It's going to be bad. You know, all these things. But the big thing is that you lose your authentic self. So how do you get that person back? How do you refind your passions? And how do you do all of that? And that's how, so I think with the spiritual stuff, because that was my first life.
Yeah, right. Which makes it even more fascinating. And we're kind of getting to the end, but about how you had that and then you kind of let go of it.
Yeah.
For this relationship. And then, but now you found your way back to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so much better on the other side. But you know, again, it's not like we are seeking out these experiences. You know what's interesting? I was thinking about this the other day. When I was in my early teens, would pray a lot for wisdom. And I just found out, I had a reading with a friend who's a psychic, and he does feng shui. I don't know how much you know about that. But I found out that I'm a two energy. And it's the teacher, and it's all about wisdom and understanding. And so, you know, when I was younger, I'd pray for wisdom. Like, I don't know, it was weird. Like, who does that when you're in your teens, you know? And I remember reading in the Bible about, like, King Solomon, and he was the wisest and had all this understanding and knowledge and stuff. And so I would pray that. Well, to get wisdom and understanding and knowledge, you have to go through things. You have to live life.
Right. Right. It goes back to that whole idea of like, be careful what you pray for.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how that lesson's going to come to you.
Exactly. And so like in my head, I'm like, well, I want like the big palace. I want Solomon's the wisest and he has all these big things. So I'm praying like, okay, tomorrow I'm going to get that. No, the universe is going to give you exactly what you want. Mm-hmm. But not always in the way you think. And to get wisdom, you have to live.
Yeah,
you have to go through things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they call it like trauma wisdom. Freaking wisdom.
right. All wisdom is, for the most part, all wisdom is
learned experience.
Some kind of tribulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stephanie, what is your song that you listen to when you need a boost of energy and something to hype you up?
Yeah, so I really like that song by Sia, Unstoppable, because that is how I feel now. You know, I've started to dream again. I've returned to my authentic self. I have goals. I have a vision for my life, and I feel unstoppable. And when I get on the treadmill, I put that on, listen to it. It's like, I am unstoppable.
I love it. That's such an awesome song. If someone wants to continue this conversation with you, where's the best place for them to find you?
So right now I'm on LinkedIn and on Facebook. I'm trying to get some other things set up. You know, because my ex-husband passed away a couple months ago, I don't work one-on-one with people. I'm not a coach. And I've decided to take this year off and just holding space for my kids right now. And I'm writing a series of books. Follow me on Facebook, follow me on LinkedIn, and there's going to be some really exciting stuff coming out soon.
Cool. I will put links to those places in the show notes so people can go find you there. Thank you so much for joining me today on Fine is a Four-Letter Word.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Stephanie Ann has packed a lot into the approximately 40 years she's been alive. Speaker, author, world traveler, adventurer.
attorney, EFT practitioner, storyteller, and survivor of narcissistic abuse who empowers other survivors. From her fascinating story, I found several key takeaways. Number one, while the idealization phase, where you have the story of who someone is because it's who you want them to be, is something narcissists exploit, it's a common experience. It happens in new relationships, new jobs, all kinds of situations, because we make up stories in our minds to fill in the details we don't yet know. Keep a clear mind and maybe ask people around you what they're seeing to determine whether what you're experiencing is an authentic reality. Number two, when you're looking from the inside out, you can't see the lessons the universe is trying to teach you. For Stephanie Ann, part of the epiphany was becoming physically blind, but you may be metaphorically blind. Stephanie divorced one narcissistic man only to marry a second who was remarkably similar to the first. What was the pattern? What lens was Stephanie looking through that distorted her vision? Number three, when you view people who harm you as monsters trying to destroy you, you can miss the lessons you're supposed to learn. By making the shift from seeing her husbands as monsters toward viewing them as teachers, she saw what she needed to heal and release and could finally break these patterns of calling in these toxic, abusive men into her life. Number four, I've said it before and I'll keep saying it. Trusting your intuition and spiritual awareness is crucial, even when you're faced with external doubt or conflicting perceptions. Only you can hear your own inner voice and what it's telling you. And sometimes it doesn't make sense, but it's always right. Number five, I loved Stephanie's term of putting up a kitty fence and thinking it was a boundary. When Stephanie's husband was cheating on her with other women, she tried to set boundaries. Don't cheat on me and stay away from my husband. In doing so, she was trying to set other people's boundaries and in the process failed to set her own. This meant her husbands could continue to violate her personhood. When you try to change other people, you're the one who becomes conditioned to changing for others. You can only change yourself.
Thanks for listening to Fine is a Four-Letter Word. If you've enjoyed the show, please follow and share it with a friend. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite platform to help others discover it too. You can find links to my socials on my website, zenrabbit.com. And before you go, take a moment to reflect on what you're grateful for today. Remember, you have the power to create a life you love, and I'm proud of you. Thanks for joining me. Take care.